Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. On a Thursday, it's time for the Lynch and Kenny event. So joining me from Texas is Tim Lynch. Doc, how are you doing?
Doing fine, Mac. Yourself?
I got no issues right now. And from Southern California, Jeff Kenny. Jeff, what's up?
How are you? I'm doing good.
I'm all right. The wanted to do either of you, both of you, do you guys know Gunnar Galinas?
Yes, I know him pretty well.
How do you know him?
Because when we were trying to get lieutenants out to 29 Palms in starting in 2001, and then we finally achieved in 2002, one of our main contacts out there was retired Gunnar Galinas.
Right.
And at the same time, I was the first IOC director to have his own gunner, Gunnar Charette, who also was the senior gunner in the Marine Corps at that time. It was more of a – things were less structured. He was the senior guy. And we were out there and we saw everybody, all the major units at 29 Palms, looking basically for a godfather to help us with the lieutenants. We finally ended up doing it with TECG. But what really galvanized us, another thing that galvanized us there was Charette was trying to get Galinas back on active duty.
Right.
Because of his combat experience.
Right.
And kind of what I remember really charging up was Lieutenant Colonel Clarity, the CO of 3rd LAR, and he's like, I don't have a gunner. And we don't have anybody in the unit. I mean, nobody who's ever heard a shot fired in anger. And Galinas had heard many shots fired in anger, and he was already a legendary guy. Now, at that time, he was a high school janitor for the 29 Palms High School.
He says really more of a bouncer than a janitor.
Yes, yeah, that's what he told us. He's like, these motherfuckers, and because he's got that, either Worcester or
Massachusetts,
or
And wait, like, Timmy knows where he's from. What's the name of that town?
Yeah. Woonsocket. There used to be signs that would say, drive careful your car, because there were a lot of French-Canadian folks in Woonsocket. They had a hell of a lacrosse team. They could play hockey, too.
So Charette did it. He got Gunner back in active duty, and Gunner went to OIF-1 with Stacy Clarity.
Right.
But so I got to know him pretty good then, and we talked. I had a gunny when I first came in who was the head of the Nuclear Ordnance Platoon, which is a guard guys at 29 Palms.
Right.
And his name was, I can't remember right now, but the guy in the Navy Cross from Operation Buffalo, and he's in 1-9, and I believe the same company. But Galinas had a bunch of stories about this guy. Leon Burns was the guy's name, Leon Burns. Staff sergeant when he got the Navy Cross. He retired as a gunny. He was a very rotund individual. That's why I had to get out of the Marine Corps. But I think he managed to get 20 years. But he retired in like 76, I think. But he got the Navy Cross in Operation Buffalo. And now, talking to Gunner, he had so many stories about, Leon Burns and about Captain Curd, who was my battalion commander in boot camp, and then a captain, though, in 1-9. And Captain Slater, I think, was the other guy, Alpha Company, another Navy Cross guy from Operation Buffalo. And he knew all about it. Now, then he saw a lot of shit with 1-9 himself, when they earned that title, Walking Dead. And whenever I go back to 29 Palms, I was back there in ATG. Gunner was working in up there in range control.
Right.
And then he was in ops. He's a very valuable individual out there.
Oh my God! So I sent him an email yesterday because I didn't have a picture of him to put with the post that we do a battlefield study. And he's a PFC, an 18-year-old PFC at Con Tien and Khe San, initially with Bravo 1-9, then he goes to, I want to say, Bravo 126 or Alpha 126.
Right.
And so I think it's Alpha 126. It is Bravo because he knows Ken Pipes, who is in that documentary. Anyway, so he calls me at 5:15 this morning.
My phone
rings, right? And I was awake, right, as insomniacs tend to be. Hello? Matt. Gunner. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, hey, I'm going to send you a couple pictures. I'm like, all right. Why the fuck are you calling me at 5:15? Are you out of your mind?
He's already been up for an
hour. I know. He's up for an hour. It sounded like it was midday for him. Anyway, Timmy, how do you know?
I don't. I know of him because right. when the very first class of gunners came through the basic school, I was SPC for them. So I met him, I believe, at their graduation. I don't think he came through the course, though. I think he just got made gunner.
Oh, man, he did go through the course because he's a bitch. He did not – he was not a John Kelly fan.
No, they had a revolt. I won't say a revolt, but, you know, the thought was, well, we'll put him through IOC. But, you know, it's like, hey, look, we've made a living doing this stuff.
Yeah.
What we need to know – and then Kelly, they shifted gears, I want to say, maybe a third of the way through the course. And they, you know, lieutenants would be doing these things, gunners would be doing these things, and then certain exercises, they'd all be together and whatnot. So they could.
Because, like, you had Gunner Nevglowski and Gunner Lowry, and a lot of great fuck guys who were in that class.
Class. Well, I mean, the gunner program been.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been, you know, I don't know how good it's been for the staff NCOs, but it's been great for the gunner community and, you know, everybody who relies on that billet. The all right, let's talk about that battlefield study. Tim, you got a chance to listen to it. Jeff hasn't listened to it yet, but any thoughts on it, Tim, listening to it?
Well, it once again, how strange is it that you fly across the, you know, the Pacific, you end up in Da Nang or someplace, you just get shipped off to a battalion where you don't know anybody, you meet your platoon sergeant, and an hour later, you're carrying his body for the next 2 days, and you're 18 years old. It's that one aspect of Vietnam. It's just hard to wrap your mind around. And the gunner sounds, he's an unusual cat because he seemed to have been able to take all this stuff in stride, but yeah. He had a hell of a damn steep learning curve, and But man, talk about, that's rough shit, you know? That is really, really rough.
No, you hear it and you think about it kind of with your lens, you know, tilted a little bit, tilted towards today, right? And he joins Bravo 19 at Khe San, right? On Hill 881 and, you know, during the hill fights, and then they go to Con Tien and he's with them. Now he doesn't, I'm not sure the exact reason, but he doesn't go on Operation Buffalo. Whether his platoon was pulling like guard duty around the perimeter of the base, and they didn't go. I don't know. But he talks about it. Then, you know, and he talks about how vicious the fighting was, and how what a formidable foe the NVA was. And then he tells a really pointed story about volunteering to be night security for the bridge at Dong Ha, thinking he'd get out of work during the day, it'd be a good deal. He says it didn't really work out like that. But he gets caught sleeping, and they send him over to Graves Registration for 2 days, and he talks about what he saw there. And again, 18, 19 year old kid. And so, as Tim said, so Khe San, Con Tien, Graves Registration, and then if you read his Silver Star citation, it's in the vicinity of the Hai Van Pass, and they've got dogs with them, and I'll read you the citation right now. I just pulled it up. President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Silver Star to Corporal Timothy K. Galinas, United States Marine Corps, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action while serving as a sentry dog handler with Company B, 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, 1st Marine Division, Reinforced, Fleet Marine Force in connection with combat operations against the enemy in the Republic of Vietnam early on the morning of 11 November 1968 while leading an ambush patrol in defense of a gasoline storage facility near the Hai Van Pass in Quang Nhi Province. Sergeant Galinas was alerted by his sentry dog to the presence of the enemy and quickly deployed his men into ambush positions. As the North Vietnamese Army platoon, augmented with Viet Cong sappers, entered the fire zone, he triggered the ambush and inflicted severe casualties on the enemy. During the ensuing fierce firefight, a Marine was hit by an enemy round and fell directly in the line of fire. With complete disregard for his own safety, Sergeant Galinas dashed into the open, placed himself between his fallen comrade and the enemy, and delivered a steady volume of suppressive fire while several Marines moved forward and evacuated the wounded man to a covered position. Although he himself was seriously wounded, while protecting his fellow Marines, Sergeant Galinas remained in the open, continued to fire his weapon until assured that the casualty was safe and the men were in a defensive position. Then, resolutely refusing medical attention, he encouraged and directed his men until reinforcements arrived and the hostile force was routed. His heroic actions at the risk of his own life inspired all who observed him and were instrumental in saving the life of a fellow Marine. So, that's no shit right there, man. That's not, that's not running out and grabbing him. I mean, that's having the presence of mind. The presence of mind, that used to be a block, right? That used to be a block on a fitness report that could only be written about
in combat.
In combat. Right, back in the old gore. And he had the presence of mind to think, I've got to get out there. I've got to protect him. I've got to suppress those guys. So, and then coordinate, hey, I'm going to go hop out there and protect him, right? I'll cover you. You come behind me, you grab him, and then we'll all hopefully get back. But that's some serious, I mean, that's some serious fortitude. So, I mean, again, so you see the things that he does. And again, 1967, 1968, I mean, it wasn't a whole lot of time that there wasn't a whole lot of shit going on and the Marines were not right dead on. So,
see that battalion, man.
Yeah.
The battalion turned over fucking the roster a couple times.
Right.
67, right. And 69. They were Dewey Canyon guys, too. I mean, Alpha 19 was Wes Fox, you know, and
right.
February of 69. So.
Right. No, and so you hear the stories of both Barney Barnum and now a battery commander. He's already the recipient of the Medal of Honor.
Right, as a
first lieutenant. And then he goes back as a battery commander, and he fires for Wes Fox in 69 when Fox is Alpha 19, right? And in the action that, you know, leads to his Medal of Honor. So, pretty interesting. Interesting, if you haven't listened to it, I did an interview with Barney Barnum when Wes Fox passed away, and Colonel Fox. And it's a really cool interview. Find it. Just go to just type in the word Fox or Barnum, either one of them, and it'll come up. And it's a really cool interview. And Barnum tells a story about how he meets Lieutenant Fox. I'll tell it real quick. Alpha 19 is the company that's providing security for the firebase that Barnum is, his artillery battery is owns, right? So, but the grunts are down the hill protecting it, and the battery's up on the crest and on the different fingers coming off. So anyway, with the gun positions and all that. So from the bottom of the hill, they hear explosions. So Barnum yells at his battery gunny, "What the fuck is going on?" He says, "I don't know. That's Alpha Company 19." He goes, "You get that lieutenant's ass up here right now." Right? So he says, "Yes, sir." So the gunny goes, he gets like either second lieutenant or first lieutenant Fox,
right.
Probably first lieutenant Fox. And he comes, so Barnum's pissed and is going to chew his ass, right? And so into his, right, CP tent, right, comes the real life John Wayne. Lieutenant Fox reporting his order. And then Barnum turns and looks. He goes, "Who the fuck are you?" He says, "I'm the CEO of Alpha 19. He goes, "Right." And he was like, what? He was the first sergeant selectee. He goes, "Hey, what the hell are you doing down there?" And he said, "Well, we don't have any fresh water, so we got to go down the stream. So I send Marines down to bathe, right? So they get water, they bathe, and then when they're done bathing, we drop hand grenades in the water, and then we yoke up the fish, and then we have some fresh food."
Right.
And so he says, "Well, shit, why don't you tell somebody what you're doing?" But he talks, and it's really funny because the way he talks tells the story, right? He's pissed, and then, you know, I mean, if you ever want to see a poster Marine, the guy who, if you were going to make a movie about a Marine, right, you'd say, "Get me somebody who looks like that guy," and that was Colonel Fox. I mean, there's a picture.
That was a special commissioning thing for like only a handful of senior staff. I mean, these guys are gunnies and first sergeants.
Well, what he said, and because who was the other guy they said it was like
Lovingood was one of those guys.
4,000. There was like between 4,000 and 5,000 guys. Ultimately, they got commissioned, right. and it was a. Oh God, he only had a high school degree, and he's a lieutenant colonel, and he gets a letter from the Marine Corps that says, "You are the only officer above the rank of major with no college degree. The Marine Corps would like to see you get a degree, or you will be asked to either revert or resign." And so he went and he got his degree. God, what's his name? He's a
The command officer for the gunner at that California, what the hell were they at? Lemoore or something?
Yes. What's his name, Tim?
Yeah. I remember. I don't remember the guy's name because you've talked to him several times. He's been on the show.
Yeah.
Hard
as woodpecker lives, Tucker, too.
Arnold?
No.
I'm sorry. I've got the wrong name.
That's kind of like the guy who wrote those books, One More Bridge to Cross and Last 100 Yards. He was a major and he got reverted to a gunny. He started writing those books.
No, not the same guy.
Not him. Yeah, I know. I'm not. Right. So yeah, I'm wondering who that guy. Do you know any idea what unit he was in? Like or.
No, it'll come to me. Now I want to kind of. Trent, do you think the way that we fought? Could we do that? Could we the way we fought those hill fights, mm-hmm. the way we resupplied under artillery fire? Do you guys think could we do that now?
No.
I have a hard time imagining it.
Yeah, I mean, before we came on, we're sitting here talking about where we were going to go, and Jeff was describing Colonel Dabney, then Captain Dabney's fight on 881, and how many helicopters got shot down, and the dilemma he had with casualties and helicopters, et cetera. But you can't even, I mean, in us, you can't even have this conversation when you're talking our current medium lift capability. Because an officer can't do anything but an administrative landing.
And Iraq.
If you're going to land where there's no enemy, the Army can do that. So what the hell, you know?
I remember being there in 2006 in Anbar, and if the weather was bad, they wouldn't let you off the FOB because the air, you know, the ceiling's too low for the air. So they're like, then that means if you get in trouble, it's too dangerous for them to come get you. So you were stuck at – this is the one time we should have been out when the weather was bad, because the only guys who were bigger weather pussies than fucking than the air wing guys was the Moosh. You know, they hated. They don't want to sit out there in the fucking rain and shit. You know, and wait to do complex.
I always moved in the rain whenever it was raining. Particularly when I lived in Lashigar and had to move through the Helmand. When there was a big rain on, that's when I moved and went to see my projects and whatnot. Yeah. That's the time to be out there.
Yeah. That's because of risk adversity. Of the air wing, you know, now. And I don't think.
Bathurst! You know, Jim Bathurst.
Yes, Bathurst. He was the CO of like 1-8 when I first got to 3-8. He ended up as the CO of SOI East.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
right,
right. Bathurst. Bathurst's the name. Grunton's the game. That's what you'd say. But he's like 600 years old.
The guy and looked like he was 700 years old.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, dude, what's it? You know, he's one of those guys whose fingers are bent in the shape of a coffee cup and like a cigarette, right? And then you know, he puts them down and they still stay like that. No, but I mean, those guys were commissioned out of that program. I told Bathurst, that's one of the coolest letters I've ever heard of. You're a lieutenant colonel. And I said, I'd have blown that up and framed it. And like,
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I'm a high school graduate and I'm a lieutenant colonel. Do you guys know why? Because I'm a fucking baller, that's why.
He had Sheehan was our regimental commander when he was the CO-1A, and then for a little bit with Ray Smith.
Right. And they, you know, right? And they'd all cross paths.
They didn't do command selection then.
Right.
So the division commander, I think, picked the battalion commanders in those days.
So that would be a little bit of a good old boys network.
Yeah.
Right, boys, you know, now, watch
and that good old boys network was so shitty that we haven't really won a war since, but, you know, that's neither here nor there.
So I'm going to seamlessly transition back to the topic at hand. You ready? With another baller.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so one of the books.
Well, hold on. I want to say this about medium lift. We talked about this in 2010, and it's really interesting because the Osprey guys insist that they can do that it's such a better platform than the 46 was.
And it is.
Depending on what? Yeah. Like if I want to be MUSOC over the horizon guy, but let me tell you, we've lost our tactical mobility because the Osprey is a China doll. You can't break one. You can't get them shot at. And they'll say, oh, that's bullshit. Oh, no, it's not bullshit.
No, it isn't bullshit, but that's not because of the bird. That's because of the humans.
Right. Okay. And so we could talk about that. But the other thing, though, and again, maybe this is me, but this is my experience. The Osprey, when it transitions from forward, okay, picture this for everybody who's an old corps person. A 46 flying Nap of the Earth, right? Or a Huey flying, you know, through a valley, right? And when they get to the LZ, what do? They kind of do that aerial skid, flare, poof, down, ramp down, is already down, boom, down, everybody out, right? Up, nose down, poof, and pull out of there. That is a five-minute evolution for an Osprey. They go horizontal to kind of vertical to kind of this fat fucking duck trying to slow down and come under control. It does not, this is just me, and maybe I'm fucked up, it does not have the agility in and out of a zone that the 46 had, that the Huey has, that the Black Hawk has. And
yeah,
so we have a problem in terms of medium lift. I just wanted to get that off my chest because I've been living with that for a long time.
But on the other hand, you know, it's a trade-off. What are you going to put your money on? I mean, I hated that thing all through the late 90s up till, you know, it finally got, you know, issued out. Because I don't think it was until 2004, maybe 2005, we had as many dead guys in Iraq as we had killed trying to test the Osprey.
Right.
You know? And so it kind of pissed me off. And then the fact when we finally, I was in WTI in 96, and I'm like, this fucking bird doesn't have any windows in it. How are you going to shoot out of it? Where's the part for the guy with the guy who can, you know, suppress the enemy? You're coming in. We're going to land you where the enemy isn't. Oh, we heard that before.
Well, you better, hey, let me tell you better hope the enemy ain't there, because when they go like slow ass shit, right?
So,
let me just tell you, I watched I'm not sure if it was a G-Boss, so camera on a stick, or if it was an aerostat camera, so camera on a blimp, watching an Osprey come in and land at FOB Delhi or some shit.
Right,
South of Garmshire, or in the vicinity of Garmshire, south of, I was going to say Nasser al-Salam, but that's in Iraq, south of Lashkar Gah. So anyway, somebody either shoots an RPG or they have remotely fired something. Poof! That, and this thing, it goes flying. It's like, you know those ducks when they go to land on a lake, and but it's ice, and they hit the ice, and they go, phew! That's what the Osprey is. It's like, it's in this kind of extremely vulnerable position, because it's powering down, and then you try to power up, and it ain't happening very fast. And everybody had a conniption fit. Whoa, whoa! And I said, oh, hey, you know, I forgot. Aviators aren't supposed to die in this war. Because it's always such a big deal when an aviator dies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? And it, and you know what? And I said that. Both of our air officers were great guys. And I can't, and I won't go into the what happened. But it pissed me off. Because it was like this horrible thing had happened. And it was like, wait a minute. We're packing Lance Corporals out of here every other day.
Yeah, I know. That pisses me off.
Yeah, anyway. The aviation community doesn't suffer too many casualties these days. So that brings us to the question. Could we, I mean, Jeff, talk a little bit about the raw courage of Huey and 46 pilots, you know, in those hill battles in Vietnam.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole reason why they're able to maintain those hill positions, 881 and 861 and 950 and so forth, is because of the constant resupply and, when necessary, medevac done mainly from 46s and, to a lesser extent, Hueys. Only lesser because we just have less of them in the Marine Corps. And the 46s would fly from one of the air bases that was relatively secure to Khe Sanh, and from Khe Sanh go to do resupplies and stuff for these hills, and it's constant. There's no ground way of getting to those positions. And we at IOC, one time when I was a captain and one time when I was the director, we had Colonel Dabney, retired, whose last command of note was CO of 9th Marines in the late 70s, or early 80s rather. But he was the company commander for India 326 in 67 and 68. At Khe Sanh, on Hill A81. He took Hill A81 in December, and he stayed there through the whole thing. And they basically made a fort out of it. He had 105 platoon, at least two 105s. He had like a section 81s. He had his 60s, and they shot indirect fire like it was cool. And one of the lieutenants asked him, I remember when I was a captain, one of the lieutenants said, "Sir, what do you believe is the best close air support platform that the Marine Corps or that you can use in combat?" And Dabney, without missing a beat, says, "A B-52. So, because up there, you needed that, you know? And so he's telling the story about one morning before dawn, and that's when they got their resupplies in.
Hold on a second. I mean, think about him saying that, right? Think about him being on those hilltops. Right, and those B-52 strikes coming in around right those hills and that hill complex. Amazing. I mean, the shit that the ordnance that they saw dropped, you know, and how they used to they must have prayed to God, kill every one of them if you can. It's
I mean, the arc light's like what, 1 500-pound bomb every 100 square yards for 1,000 yards. So it's like a carpet of death.
And so he's B-52, people go, haha. And he'd look at you and say, "What do you mean? I'm not joking."
I mean, if
you
could, bullshit. Man.
Yeah, if you could see when you know, four or five or six B-52s lay waste about four or five grid squares, it's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing.
That's how we made the Northern Alliance win in fucking Afghanistan in 2001. You know?
Exactly right.
Anyway, Jeff, keep going with your.
So they're getting a resupply, and it's an indirect fire resupply. So it's an external load with 105 rounds on it, a bunch of increments, 81s and 60s. And just as the bird's coming into the little LZ they have, it's a one spot LZ, they get hit by indirect fire from the MBA. And I don't know if it was mortars or reverse slope arty or whatever, but hit them right on the button. And the bird didn't get hit. But it did damage the external load, so all the ammo went tumbling down the hill in the dark. So Dabney immediately, you know, they organized a patrol that went down the hill and policed up all that ammo and brought it back up. And he talks about that. It's like an ass-busting thing because that hill is like no joke. And they're trying to find this ammo in the dark. And the NVA didn't fire him up again, really. I mean, they're shooting at the top of the hill, not the guys, you know, but they got the ammo and they hauled it back up there. And when they got to the top, they had another, they got hit by indirect fire again, and two guys got wounded, I think one killed. And so they call in a medevac. And here comes a 46 screaming up from the combat base. And he lands there, and they're loading the dudes in and shit like that. And the bird gets hit by an NVA round, and right amidships breaks in half. Now there's at least one of the crew members dead. The other guys are wounded, and now they too need to be medevaced. So the grunts from India 326 are hauling a piece of this bird to get it off the LZ so another one come in. Another one comes up. And, you know, I'm trying to remember now. This one got driven away by fire, and it was like smoke and everything like that, and went twisting down towards the back to the combat base. But immediately passed by it, another one came up. And this guy tries to land the LZ, and he gets hit, and another bunch of casualties. So now they got two air crews worth of casualties. They got the Marines who were initially wounded, and then other Marines who got hit trying to get them out of the LZ and stuff. You basically got about like 12 or 13 priority medevacs, and seven or eight or five or six routine guys who were dead, and so. Another guy comes in. Now, this guy says to, and he's talking to Dabney, because in those days, the company commander was the FAC. He was the FO for RD. He was everything. He had, like, you know, when he's coordinating, he was the one coordinating. So Dabney's talking to the guy, and the guy says, hey, look, I'm not going to go to that LZ. I mean, I'm getting a hint that it's not good. So, but I'm looking at this hill. Can you get your guys up to this little spur? You know, it's like near the top of the hill, and we'll try and get them off. And then he goes, roger that. So another working party of carrying wounded guys, and they're basically relaying, you know, they're relaying these guys up like through a human chain, and they get them to the thing when the 46 guy lowers the ramp a little bit. He backs up to the rear of the thing. I remember, thinking, that's incredible. Cause picture somebody doing that. Like at Ballbuster over there by Recon here at Camp Pendleton, you know? It's just incredible.
No, you've seen, and most people have seen pictures of something like that in Afghanistan, right, on the eastern, northeastern side, right. In the mountainous side, where the army would have these firm bases or outposts up on top of these mountains, and you see somebody, you know, a 47 with its back two wheels on some kind of platform.
Well, that's where Tim and I were my first tour. That area was up in Kunar and Nuristan.
Right.
You had the Korangal and shit like that. That's how that was,
right.
Exactly. And, you know, it was very – so this guy, he does it. And he's getting hit, and Dabney's talking to him. A bunch of blue-green tracers hit the rear of the 46. He goes, hey, you got fire in your rear. The guy says, roger. He goes, it was like talking to a guy at a ball game, baseball game. The guy was dead calm. Then another bunch of rounds hit the middle of the bird. And meanwhile, the Marines are pulling guys. They're getting guys on. The wounded guys are pulling other wounded guys on. And the crew chief guys are working their ass off and everything. And the bird every once in a while has to drift off. It's not made to just hang there like that. And then the next, he gets the thing loaded. Starts to turn to take off. And the windshield explodes, you know, by automatic weapons fire. But the guys okay enough to fly the plane. And the plane's smoke is coming out of the 46 from three different places. Colonel Dabney's telling lieutenants. And, you know, lieutenants are sitting there at the fireside chat there between the weapons and live fires with their mouths open, you know. And the bird twists and turns and in flames, goes down, but successfully lands at Khaisan, the combat base. And everybody, the whole India company reinforced is cheering and shit like that. And he gets a call on his field phone because they're all tied in. you know, basically a trench defense that defended that hill. And it's one of his corpsmen says, "Sir, we got another one. And he ain't going to make it unless we get a bird in here." And so Dabney's like, "Jesus." So he says to the lieutenants, "So what do you do, men?"
Okay, so hold on. Just you didn't tell everybody. He comes to what, a fireside chat out at IOC?
Right. Okay. Yes. Now, he came the first one. He was good to go. The second one he came to, he had just had prostate cancer surgery. It took me like 20 minutes to get him from where his car was, which is about 50 feet, 50 yards maybe, down to where he had the fire for the chat.
Right.
And he's like, he kept telling me, "They rung my bell, Jeff. They rung my bell." You know, and but he came down and he told that, he, you know, he's telling a story. And he doesn't tell lieutenants what he did. He says, "So what do you do, man? I'm not going to tell you. You think in your own mind. Because if you call them, they'll come. And we already lost two birds there. And we already lost, you know."
So when you lose a bird, you have the pilot, the co-pilot, you have a crew chief, and you have two gunners, right?
Well,
or
at
what,
least.
Or
you have at least four guys.
At least four. Maybe five.
A crew chief and a gunner, and sometimes five.
All right. Okay. All right. That's on a 46.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he told me, you know, we're back at IOC, and this guy was Chesty Puller's son-in-law. I don't know if you guys know that.
Yeah.
He was married to Chesty Puller's daughter.
Yeah,
and he says, yeah, well, he told me on the drive back to the IOC, he goes, I didn't call a bird back in. I couldn't do it. He goes, I knew he'd lose another one. He said they were more accurate every time we brought one of those birds in. We were doing everything else we could. That's the other part of the story, you know. They're trying to get air to suppress this shit, but they're so. We talked a little bit about this before. The skill of the NBA about those indirect fire positions. You never even see a signature, or if you saw a signature, it's not really the one you got to worry about. They're shooting that one to deceive you to think that, you know, there's a, or they're just setting off small, you know, C4 charges, make you think that's, you know, that's the signature of fire, and so you're wasting your suppressive rounds on a position that doesn't really exist. So they're desperately trying to do that at the same time these guys are doing the medevac. So it's like, and when you ask, I mean, when you ask, could we do that now? I mean, I don't even know if I could not, it would be hard to not call in that bird for a guy. You know you're going to know the guy. Maybe you're going to know him good, you know, and, but, you know, it's just a hard thing. It's the right call, I think, that he made, but, it's a rough thing, for sure.
Well, you know, and so talk about this. So in a near peer or a peer war, with the lethality of modern munitions, how do you do it?
Yeah.
How do you do it? How do you medevac?
Question then is too, Mac. Why would you need to be on that hill? You know, in light of what you said about the modernity of things.
Right.
You might not need to, but you're going to have a situation that's similar where you got to make a blood over machine call. You know, it's not really a blood over machine call, but it's a certainty
right.
over a probability call, you know?
Right. And now let me ask, we don't have enough machines to get them blasted out of the sky on a regular basis.
Right.
I mean, so to me, one of the things that you look at when you look at the American military, this is my opinion, we're not built to fight a peer. Because what we've done is we bought shit that's so expensive, we can only afford so many of them. And we haven't looked and said, okay, if we're going to fight the Chinese, it's an all-in event, right? And we're going to suffer this many casualties, right? And we have to have this many aircraft, right, ready to be moved into the AO to replace, but we don't have that.
You're right. And they used to be able to make hard decisions on a basically a strategic level like that. For instance, you take the Sherman tank from World War II. That tank was inferior to at least three of the German tanks they had.
In every measurable way.
Yeah. But we had a much better... You know, it was a good tank. It was pretty, you know, pretty resilient and stuff like that. And you could fix it quick. And you could get swarms of them. And so they went with the decision of, well, hey, tank on tank fight. You know, we're going to need to do combined arms to a T. I mean, they had the tank destroyers, you know, those,
right.
But they had no armor to speak of. And it became basically the precursor to the tactics we had with our cat platoon thing, where I'll shoot my machine gun at that fucking T-80, or you take him out with a tow. He'll be so distracted by my Mod Deuce rounds bouncing off his turret, he won't notice that it takes 10 seconds for your round to hit him from the time you shoot it. You know what I mean? A version of that was the Sherman engages at short range, gets blown away at the rapid rate, and the tank destroyer takes the guy out from afar. I mean, that only works when you got a shitload of air and your enemy doesn't.
Right, and
you're right though about the ability to have so much of that we could take losses.
Right
now, I don't think we could take those losses and still have that level of technology advantage.
No, right? So I mean, when you talk, so to me, and the great example is the Navy.
Right.
Our ships are too expensive for us to build a lot of them. Right, and so we have pretty small, sophisticated. But if they start getting sunk, we don't have the ass to replace that.
That's right.
So how do you run a medevac? Right, in a peer event where they can zap your shit out of the sky? Do you not?
Yeah, I remember in 2001 we're getting ready to put those ODA teams in. There is controversy in the chief of staff of the army, because there's no golden hour for those guys.
Right.
I mean,
it's only the final hour.
Right. That's right.
There's no, yeah, right. I mean, cause it ain't coming. We can't get it there.
Yep.
So
it really wasn't until, you know, we went in there and, you know, established Rhino and a couple other places that you're able to actually have medevacs.
Right.
Yeah. But letting the medevac cover and availability drive your entire deployment decisions.
Horrible. You're right.
I don't see that as being a wise move. You know.
Okay. Hold on. But that's where we are. Yeah. That's a huge consideration. And let me tell you. So to me, what you see in this discussion, you have, you know, Captain Dabney. You know, you have his narrative that Jeff was talking about. The decisions that those guys had to make. You had Operation, I don't know which one it was, Prairie 3, Hastings, I don't know, one of them. You know, 550 NVA killed in a 2 or 3 week span, 175 Marines KIA, right? And that was just one named operation, okay?
Right.
That's the level of violence in a peer or near peer fight, right? And now it's been so long since we've done shit like that. So our conception of war is, right, casualties and onesies and twosies. We're going to have the luxury to have a golden hour.
Right.
And that's how we conceive it now. Okay. Okay.
Well, and there's a reason for that.
It's because everything's permissive, right?
Because the enemy's like, we're not going to take these guys on in a combined arms fight. They will destroy our integration. They will strip away our combined arms capability, such as it is, you know, rapidly and decisively. I mean, you look at Desert Storm and OIF-1, it's just shocking for the guy. Like, the guy, first guy I advised, he had been a brigade commander in OIF-1. He's like, I couldn't talk. I couldn't see. Then we started getting fake messages from people who spoke Arabic better than we did. And then this happened, and I got attacked by that. He points out, you know, a couple of cobras on the ground. Then we got attacked by that. He points at some AEVs. This is on Al-Assad, you know. They came up our rear and everything, and they captured us. And, you know, so from hearing his perspective on it, everybody tries to have, in peer-to-peer fights, an integrated force. What we have become adept at, and in some ways to our detriment, you know, in long-range ways, long-term ways, is the fact that we can disintegrate. We pick apart the integration that the enemy has so that it's just a walkover. And so they find other ways, and that's what we're in now. We're in the other ways. You know, they try and get waltz us into a coin environment where, you know, where the fighting takes place among highly populated areas, and when the innocents or people who appear to be innocent get hurt, our news, you know, the news media makes their money out of clicks and, you know, and controversial stories. So they will always report it, even when it's not really true. It just sounds good.
But it doesn't matter because our center of gravity, and they all know it, right, is the soft
public opinion.
Yeah, is public opinion. And the critical vulnerability is our open media. And so, like they learned in Vietnam, right, you can get the shit knocked out of you, right, which is
still
exactly
what you want.
Yeah, and still win strategically, even though you've been blood white by the American military. So I look, so if you say that in a peer fight, we're going to get as good as we give.
Right.
And so we're going to go toe to toe to somebody, and that's a peer event. How does it work? Do we have enough ass to do that?
I would submit to you that by design, nobody believes we're going to fight and be in a peer event because you couldn't even entertain the concept of women in combat if we're going to train for something like we experienced in Northern I Corps. I believe that our enlightened leaders in Washington and a lot of folks firmly believe that those days are behind us, and from now on, war means, like, you know, the girl can get out of the cab of the truck like everybody else and shoot her rifle. And that's not war. I mean, that's not war,
right,
in a professional's conception of it. And it's not been our experience within our lived lives. I mean, we've all known people who did
right.
this shit in Vietnam.
You know, I mean, right.
yet,
in order
yet
to
those do... lessons are completely forgotten. And it seems to be because we're serving. I don't know why we don't stand up more to our congressional overseers when it comes to these kind of professional questions, because we can't do it again, and we're not designed even to do it again.
Yeah. No, let me just tell you, if you define combat as what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, right, then everybody can do it.
Sure.
If that's your definition, right? And we fight in this extremely permissive environment where we have the luxury of defining what we'll do based on a golden hour. Right?
Yeah,
then you hear Dabney saying, look, we've lost two air crews and we've lost two aircraft. I've got one guy dying. Am I going to call four? Because, and again, this is the thing about Marines. They'll come, right? When you see pictures of those Huey gunships and those Cobras, and they have electrical tape on the in an X on the windshield. What do they call that thing? Not the canopy, but what do they call that fucking thing? Whatever's in the front windshield. When they have electrical tape on that son of a bitch, and that's how they're lining up targets. And they're coming. I mean, those of us who saw it in Iraq and Afghanistan, you scream help to Marines. They don't get on the phone and say, hey, what the fuck's going on? What's the best route? You know, is everything, you know, what's going on? Can we cool it out some other way? They don't say any of that shit. They come and they'll die.
When I first came in 75, it was still had a good rep. Now, by the time I'm going to command staff in like 2000, there's another guy in there. Oh, his name's Gallo or something, but he was a 46 probably. So, and here we have the CH-46, a.k.a. the whistling shit can of death. And we all laughed, but I'm kind of fond of the old 46.
I love that thing. It was the most dependable airport platform that I ever was in. That thing didn't tend to fall out of the sky. It's pretty fucking reliable, right? And it was nimble. It could get in and get out, and it could carry enough ass, right, to get you into the fight.
Yeah, because of all the all the dead 46s out there in the Yuma proving ground that we're still stripping for parts because right. they stopped making the tool and die for that stuff.
Well, again, now what you have in our inventory are quote unquote medium lift platform, right?
Right.
Doesn't do windows.
Yeah.
Because it can't. And now
now we're using the heavy. We're using 53s to do with the 46s.
Right. Right. And again, that's not as nimble, but it's a hell of a lot more nimble than the Osprey is. But, yeah. you know, the Osprey, you know, hey, over the horizon, blah, blah, blah. I got it. I got the fucking memo, man. Is that what we're going
to
do?
There's more to it than that. Let me tell you. We run out of ships, man. And the only reason we're able to be responsive in the Med and in the Gulf is because of that fucking Osprey. The long legs of that Osprey, when you combine it with the AC-130, It's a game changer.
So that's our long haul now because of our shipping issue. Okay,
right.
But where's the bridge between the Osprey and moving squads and low level Nap of the Earth medevacs? Where is that?
I'll tell you where it is, and it goes back to that decision that then Captain Dabney had to make. You know. That's a traditional triage decision. Sometimes you've got to sacrifice, you know, you've got to make decisions because you don't want to sacrifice more in order to save one life. That's a tough decision. But now that we've got the Osprey, if we ever find ourselves in a tough combat situation with a near peer or even a competent adversary, there's going to be a lot of guys making that exact same triage decision, only it's not going to be a decision because there's nobody going to be able to come and get them. There's just no way.
Yeah, you know, and something else you touched on, Mac. Those guys who did that in Vietnam, their older brothers were guys flying in Korea, and their dads were guys flying in World War II. And the guys who were running those outfits were used to a lot more attrition. And so, you know, even though the Vietnam attrition was awful, you know, it was deceptive because it was a year-by-year thing. I mean, you know, you went to World War II, and usually you were like – in three or four type big campaigns, and if you didn't get killed, maybe you got to go home. But usually those guys are in it to win it. And so, you know, I think the attitude was more like, hey, you know, this stuff's expensive, but the leadership, I mean, we're talking at the general officer level, was a lot more willing to take hits than they are now.
That's what they knew. In fact, that thought came into my head when we were talking about the you know, how going, I mean, people think back now. In fact, Galinas says it in the interview. It was the stupidest way to fight a war. Well, if you think about, okay, who were the OPSOs, the regimental commanders? They're all World War II and Korean War guys.
Mm-hmm, right.
Well, guess how we got replacements over there in World War II and Korea? They didn't go with the unit. You came in as part of the replacement, you know, regiment. Mm-hmm. And you got fed to wherever they needed you, and you learned OJT. That's how you did it. And so they looked at it as like, yeah, that's not a problem. Okay, got it. You know, we'll feed these guys in as replacements, and you'll stay for a year, and okay, all right, we've done that. And that was their – when you talk about their mental construct or you know, I talk about in decision-making, everybody looks through a prism, and that prism's cut a little bit different, and it's tinted a little bit different if you want to know why people make screwed-up decisions. And you got to understand their prism, and you got to talk to them and learn about it. So when you look at the way they looked at the world, they weren't stupid guys, right?
No.
Their combat experience was hard combat, and people got fed into it, and that was the way it was. And that's how we do it. And so that's how we did in Vietnam. And so but again, so it's like I be now I'm curious. So pure war with the Chinese, with the Russians, where we're throwing right hands, right? And aircraft are getting blown out of the sky with regularity. We don't have the ass to do that for any length of time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we actually need generals who know what they're doing because, you know, it's more than just a public relations, you know, thing. You know, it's like most of the combat we're involved in now, there's no need for anybody above a colonel to be overseas when it comes to, you know-how and shit. They're just there because, I mean, we don't even have 5,000 guys in Afghanistan. I think there's still a 3 or 4 star there. So it's like, that's not it. But these guys, if we got into one of those, Mac, especially like in the South China Sea or something like that,
yes,
or Korea, we'd need guys who really knew, because it'd have to be a blend, a real smart blend of national strategy, especially when it comes to logistics and objectives that we can take without taking so many casualties, ways we can gain leverage to minimize this stuff.
So explain to me.
You have a free society. It's a critical vulnerability.
Right.
You know,
right.
Having
so explain to me
every week.
How does it work? So your shit's got to be forward, and you got to throw. You can't be afraid to throw the first punch, and it's
right.
Got to be a thunderous. It's got to be a thunderous right hook that knocks him to his knees, and then you got to. And then, unlike the Marcus of Queensbury rules, you don't let him get up. You hit him 7 more times, and you bludgeon him to death. Because you don't have the ass to fight a protracted war? Is that how it has to be?
Something like that. Because and the other thing you just hit on, you're saying, can we do this? It's really what you mean is, are we willing to do this?
Well, are we configured to it? Because we just talked about medium lift.
Right.
I think we all agree we don't have it. I mean, that was my experience. You know, just the things that we would have liked to have done.
Well, that's what I'm talking about when I say they'd have to – you have to husband your precious forces, your resources, you know, in a really inspired way. Otherwise, you're going to lose it quick. And
what
then
that, what did that
your
mean?
Capabilities are going to shrink down.
What did that mean? What did that mean? Husband your precious resources.
Well, let's say, for instance, you only got so many Ospreys. Then you fucking use them judiciously.
We do. They're China dolls. They don't do Windows.
No, they're just risk averse. If you have to seize something, you're going to need those. I mean, when I say national strategy, I mean, I'm talking where you have to change industry to make more stuff.
We're not
talking peer-to-peer war. There's no limit, man.
What happens if there is, though? But we don't have the ass to do that. So we talk about
we've got this gigantic deficit that we keep on ignoring that eventually at some point somebody's going to have to deal with. And I think in about 6 years, there's going to be a kind of like a rebound after 6 years of winning under Trump. I believe that we might face another change of administration, and they're going to be looking for money because they're running out of money. And when they're looking for money, where do they always look? And when we don't have the ability to do a forced amphibious landing, when we don't have medium lift, when basically what we can do is the same as what the Army can do, only we can do it off ships, which the Army can do too, obviously.
But we don't have very many, and the ones we have can't get to sea.
That's what I'm saying. We're assuming that at some point somebody's going to be serious about trying to shape this gigantic military that's designed, it seems to me, to employ people in every congressional district in the country. I believe that's the purpose, sort of, right? To shape that into something that's going to be an effective tool with which to pursue some type of rational national strategy, and it's not going to happen because it's too expensive for us to expand to a meaningful level. And at some point, somebody is going to at some point there's going to be a different administration. I mean, you can't have Trumpism forever. That's not going to happen. And when that happens, I'm telling you, who's on the chopping block? We are.
Yeah.
Because that's the first thing they're going to think of is, what the hell we got two land armies for? So we could talk about media lift and whatnot. I'm more concerned about.
By that point, the answer will be easy, because because China's got 6, and they're all bigger than ours. Oh.
Six
land armies.
Oh yeah.
And they're all bigger than us. So we.
Use facts when you're talking to the Democrats. In my personal opinion, I don't want to be partisan or
how can you not be?
But facts are not relevant. We wouldn't have females in the infantry if facts were relevant. I mean, come on, bro. That's got nothing to do with anything. Facts.
No, but again, when you see the congressional testimony and the have you ever heard General Barrow's testimony?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Pretty sobering when he talks about It was, I think it was Women in Combat Arms in the early '90s. And, you know, his Louisiana Southern drawl, you know, he talks about fighting in Korea.
Yeah.
You know, and he talks about how brutal it was. And, you know, so, but again, what happens is if you can successfully define it as the limited type of war that we fought over the last 17 years, right? If you could define, if that's your definition, then everybody can do it. So let's all do it. But that's why this whole, like, Jeff, you're still like almost on active duty. Can you get the war plan for the South China Sea? And we could talk about, it next week. What's the war plan? What? So you got to get there first, and you got to beat them like a maniac beat somebody at 2:05 in the morning outside of a bar in an alley, right out behind Foggy's Notion in San Diego. You know,
that's still there.
or Pacers, right? You could go anywhere in the world. Well, you used to be able to go anywhere in the world and say Pacers was a strip joint in San Diego. Who here's got a Pacer card? And at least a third of the Marines would pull out their Pacer card. I got one. But what's the war plan? How does it, if we do fight, right? You gotta hit them first. You gotta annihilate this, or you gotta knock out these capabilities, because you're gonna lose some of yours. And then what? If you don't get them quick and you don't get them first, so I'd be curious.
It's the type of thing that a representative form of government doesn't usually
doesn't do.
You know, the ones I can think of, the Israelis who did something like that in 1967.
Right.
You know, but then
and you bet,
they
and
had the advantage.
Here's the deal, though, right? You better get them first.
Yeah. And they did, you know, and it changed the whole game. You know, up until then, we weren't really supplying them. So they were still using Sherman tanks. Cebu Play.
They did. They,
you know, the Israelis were, yeah.
They did all right with the Sherman tank.
Super Sherman, they call it.
Yeah. No, they've taken everything that we produce, and they trick that shit out, and they make it better. And
because necessity is the mother of virtue.
Well, but you know what? Let me say this before I worship at the before I worship at the altar of the IDF, right? I used to be an IDF-ophile, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then I went to Iraq and I saw the way the Arabs fight.
And you found out the answer to the great secret.
Exactly. Choose your partners wisely, right?
Yeah.
A friend of mine in college, he used to fight a fair amount, you know, and so we're talking once, and I said, hey, man, like, what's your secret to fighting? And he was laying on our couch drinking a beer, and he looks at me and goes,
be less drunk than the guy you're fighting.
No, he said, opponent selection.
Yeah.
I said, is that it? He said, that's it, man. They look like
I always win. I always win my fights, because the worst thing for me is when I hurt my hand on the size of the guy or the old lady's wheelchair. Because, you know, you got to watch that.
Exactly. No,
yes,
so then you go to Iraq and you're watching this thing unfold, and you watch the way the Iraqi army fought, and it's a shit show. They don't fight. I don't know what it is. Now, maybe, you know, after Hezbollah, maybe they have a different solution. But Hezbollah and the Israelis, if the Israelis take the gloves off, it's going to be bloody. But to me, there's no doubt who's going to win. And I don't know. I don't know why, but it changed. So opponent selection's pretty important. But the Israelis know that they can never lose. We don't have that mentality. We have these big oceans. I had Martin Van Krebeld. I took him down to... You know, I think Timmy was at IOC at the time, and I was getting ready to leave, and I was PCSing in the next month. And Major John Allen, later to be General Allen, says, Mac, I want you to take Dr. Van Krebeld down to Camp Lejeune. And I said, okay. And it was as you can imagine, I mean, for those of you who know, he's a very accomplished Israeli author and interesting guy. His family lived through the Holocaust.
Right.
And so we're driving 7 hours.
He's pretty ugly as a. He is. Yeah, I remember Paul Kennedy talking about that. He's a smart dude, man.
Oh, my God. So we're driving, and I asked him about the Holocaust. And I said, can I ask you a question? And he said, sure. I said, I asked this because I feel comfortable asking you this, and I wouldn't know. I would never ask this of somebody I didn't know. At some point in Europe, didn't everybody know that people were not coming back for a reason? And why didn't anybody fight? And he got very quiet, and he looked at me and he said, "It is our eternal shame."
Yeah.
He said, and that's the guilt that my father's generation lives with. That is the burden that we who survived it live with, is that at some point, right, we should have, the men of our culture should have stood up and said, we're having none of this, and either we fight or we die. But we are not, you know. But he talked about how good the Germans were. Hey, we're just going to move you into one part of the city for your own safety. He said, and the guy who came to tell you that was like the policeman you knew.
Yeah.
Right? And you didn't want to not believe him. And then he looked at me and he said, but after, you know, 3 and 4 years of it, there was no, he said, there is no excuse. He said,
well, you know, there was pretty good resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Well, that, again, that aside though, that, Europe's a big place, right?
Yeah,
Europe's
yeah.
a big place. And he said, we should have taken our families and we should have ran. We should have gone to the woods and we should have armed ourselves and we should have fought. And we didn't. And he said, you know, part of it is the Germans were very good systematically at doing it. But the other part is there was a time when we knew. And my father's generation, you know, it's their shame. It's really interesting. But one of the really interesting things he said on the trip down there was, he said to me, we're driving, and he said, you have no idea what a big fat pig of a nation you are, do you? I said, I'm sorry, big fat pig? Like, what do you say? No. And he said, you have these two gigantic oceans that insulate you. You have friendly neighbors to the north and south. He said, you know, we've been driving for like 4 hours now, and we're still not close to getting to a spot in your country that's relatively close to Quantico. And he said, you know, within about 15 minutes, you can drive from the coastline in some places in my country to the border. And,
yeah.
And on that border, right, sits artillery, right, sits tanks that are ready to kill us. And he said, you know, up in the Golan, he said, where Syria used to look down into my country, that's mm-hmm. the specter that we lived with. And he said, so, you know, Americans cannot even understand sometimes the way Israelis feel about things because you just don't have any conception of being at risk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're at risk from our own people, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so pretty interesting. All right, and final comments, Tim.
Well, I would say that Martin Van Covel is being a little bit too hard on the Jewish people because it is not the norm for humans to recognize that danger and rise up and offer effective resistance. That takes brave and courageous folks. And it's not as historically a normal thing.
Right.
It kind of cuts into what we're talking about here as we discuss the future of the Marine Corps and whatnot. Land of the free, as long as we're the home of the brave. But you know, the natural courage, brave guy that rises up to defend his hearth and kin, that's an idealized standard, but that's not your average person. That's an exceptional individual. And, you know, I wouldn't blame. I don't think that the Jewish response to the German oppression was any different than any other mass population that's been exterminated, be they Armenians,
yeah,
be they Russians,
like
be they
Armenians,
ever,
yeah,
else.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. But not the Irish, brother. Not the Irish. I just wanted to say that.
What do you mean, the Irish? If the Irish would have stopped drinking, grabbed a weapon, and fought, maybe it wouldn't have lasted 1,100 years.
Oh,
well, maybe not, though.
You have a little Todd now. Get up in the morning, take care of business.
I'm just saying, at some point, sober up and grab a rifle, bro.
Well, the Brits drink as much as the Irish. They just...
Well, then it would have been easy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't. You don't have to be sober. You just have to be less drunk than the opponent.
There you go.
You know, that's the key.
All right, Jeff, a final comment.
My final comment. I guess it would be that to go back to what we were talking about. Could we do the type of thing they were doing in Vietnam? Right now, we couldn't. I mean, we could. We got people who could. But I don't think we'd be willing to lose that much people and that much, hardware and stuff like that for such a apparently nebulous cause. We'd have to be like to where a lot of the people thought it was a existential type thing we're in. Otherwise, no, I don't think we could. And which is a shame too, because that type of resolve is something that's it's socialized throughout your whole life. It's not
so. So what you're telling me, right, by giving me that forecast,
right,
is that China will at some time in the next 50 years,
yeah,
dominate the world to include the United States.
No, not necessarily. Because as shitty as we are, I'm not convinced the Chinese are still good enough to beat us. And not only that,
I don't know that they'll have to fight us.
I don't know that their people are filled with solidarity as we might think.
No, I don't either. But I think the West is even less. For instance, with this whole economic thing that with them, why is it that the United States is the one standing up and saying, hey, you really need to stop the forced transfer of technology. You really need to stop the thieving, right, of intellectual property. Okay, right. You really need, now that you're a developed nation, to get over this special status with the what was it, the IMF or the World Trade Organization, all this other bullshit. Where is the rest of the free world? They're cowering.
They're all one worlders, man. They're all globalists.
No, I don't believe that. Here's what I think. What they believe is, look, if I stand up to China, they're going to pinch my ability to sell in there. And that's going to create unemployment. It's going to make my economy go bad, and I'm not going to get reelected. So I'm not going to take China on. I'm just going to...
You're talking like about Germany and France and stuff now?
Germany, France, Canada, Mexico, every son of a bitch. And again, when Barack Obama was the president of the United States... The United States did that same shit, too. We're not going to confront them. We'll bitch at them. We'll have a harshly worded statement. And then what do? We don't do shit. And so my point is this. If that is any indication that past performance is indicative of future rates of return, then you're gonna be learning Chinese.
Well, you've convinced me to run for president. If you're my campaign manager.
I will not. If nominated, I will not accept. If elected, I will not serve.
Right.
Now I know your campaign officer is not your campaign. It is not a non-elected office. I just thought I should channel Lyndon Baines Johnson right here.
Yes, and if anybody,
hey,
that's the only.
Hey,
good
I got one thing to say about the Chinese, though, brother, and that is they're only a near peer on their soil. As much as we're dogging out the military, as we highlight some of what we perceive to be deficiencies, we're still the only people that can project force in any meaningful sense of the word.
Right.
We got to fire up our allies too.
In order to be a peer, we've got to fight there. They can't come here and peer us. They can't go anywhere in PRS. They can't go. They don't have the capability to project force like we.
So I'm intrigued though with the idea of peer warfare, and how does it work? Who fights? Who runs the medevac? There is no medevac. There is no golden hour, boys. Right? You're gonna treat them. You're gonna treat them there. All this technology's got to be pushed forward because guess what? We cannot come and get you.
All right. Well, that means it means there has to be a large scale acceptance of that reality throughout our military and our political leadership.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
Yeah, I don't think so.
That ain't happening.
No, it has to take
the fact that maybe transsexuals can't serve in the active forces. So that's
No.
Accepting casualties?
No, I mean, before you get on your socialist, not your socialist, but your own rants on these things in terms of our social media and the whole social fallout of the military. No, just the reality of what a peer-to-peer war now, what does that look like? If we decided that we're going to get it on with the Russians because they do something crazy in Norway, what does that shit look like? How do we think it goes down? And Russia, right, would be the easier adversary. Except for their nukes, right?
Yeah, why would they take Norway?
I don't know. Pick a reason. The Swedish bikini team gets kidnapped, and we go to war over it.
I'd do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what we do is we hit them somewhere.
The question is, what is the Swedish bikini team doing in Norway? Well, I don't know.
The Swedish bras aren't all they're knocked up.
Hey, the bikini team is, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even know where that came from. But for whatever reason, what does it look like? What does phase one look like? What does phase two look like? Right? When the dust settles, do we have air superiority? I mean, because that's in my opinion, that is the trump card. When we can blast their shit, and look, you can sink our ships, but we're going to smoke everything you have out of the sky. And once we do that, boys and girls, you know how the rest of the dance goes. We have our way with you.
Yes, we have our way with you.
Exactly.
Once we're done with you, we'll be poor and you'll be rich.
Exactly. We'll be rebuilding you and dying in your country for a long time.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll listen to you tell us how much we suck.
Exactly. Because and then, yeah, just get us to phase four and watch us fuck that up, and then you could win. Because we don't know how to win the fucking peace.
The old Peter Sellers movie, exactly. The Mouse That Roared, man.
If you've never seen that, find The Mouse That Roared and watch it. It is hilarious. Yeah, they landed this boat on Manhattan, and they can't find anybody to fight or surrender to. And they're in this Peter Sellers. Stupid, anyway. All right, boys. Thanks for the visit. We've got to figure out pure war, though. How does it happen? How do we? If we're going to fight China.
We could be like J.F.C. Fuller and Little Heart.
Exactly.
Only thing
I thought
was
it was curses. I thought it was Liddell.
It is. It depends on what part of the mother country you're from. Like, I'm from the stupid part, so I just say it the way it looks in the book.
Little Heart.
We'd have to ask Bill Lind. He knows the right
thing. We will ask John. We will ask John Rutherford Allen. He will tell
us. Yes, Rutherford.
Sir, never call a Southern man gooba. All right, boys. Have a good night. There you have it. Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch of the Lynch and Kenny event. More of Armory Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that? I mean, in between all the stimulating conversation and the aside comments, it's moderately interesting, the whole concept of, first of all, could we do Vietnam again? I mean, put today's technology and let's go fight, and could we do it with the rate at which shit was getting blown out of the sky? Do we have enough ass to do that? When I say ass, that means, is your ass big enough, right? Are you, you know, do we have enough platforms? Do we have a war reserve shit? Because in theory, we would need it. So, anyway, interesting stuff, as well as moderately entertaining. So, all right, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial, because what you'll hear today is a little discussion about morning PT, which I'm developing in my repertoire now. Did it for a long time, and then stopped doing it. But I think it is the only sure way to make sure you do it. So we have a discussion about that. We talk a little bit about Bob Mueller, former Marine. And what he did yesterday, setting the stage for an impeachment. And, you know, will that be good or bad for the country? And what will you find more compelling? Whatever impeachment theatrics, because it'll go nowhere because the Senate is controlled by the Republicans. So it'll be political theater done by the Democrats in the House, and it'll die in the House. And then, or are you more interested in what William Barr finds in his investigation of where did all this come from? Who had their fingers on it? And I want it laid out, like one of those charts when you see like the old, what was it, the Kefauver Committee hearings on the mafia? Yeah, all of that. Yeah, charts. It starts, it's this guy's idea. Then this guy and this guy contributed. They take it to person X. That's how Hillary Clinton gets involved in it and her campaign. In the campaign, this was a point of contact. This was the funding source. They took it, and then they took it here. I'd love to see that diagram. All right, on a Thursday. And then, so you'll hear that. We'll check the news. And then you'll hear that Lynch and Kenny event that you just, if you just caught the tail end of, you'll hear that. So anyway, have a great day. I'm here in a couple of minutes. I'm going to record an interview today with an Afghan young music student. His name is Elam Fanous. I think that's how you say his name. So you'll hear that next week. But he wrote a very nice letter to American service members who had fought in Iraq that was published over the weekend. So we're going to meet him. We're going to find out about him. So anyway, on a Thursday, All Marine Radio, over and out. We'll be right back.